No, just the paragraph number.
Oh, yes, paragraph 60, concluding with, hence the inferior logos of woman's animus appears as something quite unrelated, as an inaccessible prejudice, or as an opinion which, irritatingly enough, has nothing to do with the essential nature of the object. And I said that it's a woman. It is difficult to comment on this kind of what to me seems to be labeling and categorizing without seeming to prove the point of it. However, the conclusions to me seem to be arbitrary rather than scientific. Hmm.
The unvarnished projection of that kind of attitude is that women are fascinating toys. It's a delusion, of course. If you hold to that delusion, God will kick you out of Eden every time. Go ahead.
He goes on further to state that it would be unscientific to overlook the fact that the anima is a psychic and therefore a personal autonomous system. The anima is nothing but a representation of the personal nature of the autonomous system in question. What the nature of this system is in a transcendental sense that is beyond the bounds of experience, we cannot know. Because of time, I will skip over some things. But he says, in the East there is abundance of conceptions and teachings that give full expression to the creative fantasy. In fact, protection is needed against an excess of it. We, on the other hand, regard fantasy as worthless, subjective daydreaming. Then he proceeds to say that the East came to its knowledge of inner things in childlike ignorance of the external world. We, on the other hand, shall explore the psyche in its depths, supported by an immense knowledge of history and science. At present, our knowledge of the external world is the greatest obstacle to introspection, but the psychological need will overcome all obstructions. We are already building up a psychology, a science that gives us the key to the very things that the East discovered, and discovered through only through abnormal psychic states. The next section is the detachment of consciousness from the object.
Could we place just an image in there? Go back over your notes about 2 minutes back and repeat that again, because it's worth repeating.
That the East came to its knowledge of inner things in childlike ignorance of the external world.
When Jung published that, one man in particular took exception to that. He was at Cambridge University in England. His name is Joseph Needham. And he asked himself the question, is that true? And he devoted the rest of his life to compiling those series of volumes, Science and Civilization in China, in direct rebuttal of that sentence. And I have, I think, 11 or 12 of the 15 volumes that have been published so far, about 15,000 pages of chronicling the scientific achievements of China.
Yes.
So it's a
type of thing, really.
It's important to realize that this is being written 60 years ago, and that there have been actual responses to this. And in response to that particular phrase that you singled out, you can see what a response there has been to that.
He's claiming many times over that the East is just getting its understanding from intuition, but we get ours from science.
Yes, but the phrase, I have to reduce it again so that you can make it graphic, like the hidden expression for the lack of understanding a woman is that a woman is really a fascinating toy. The other expression is that Asians are learning by imitation their science from us. Both of these are patently idiotic as soon as you make them. That you can see that if one does not know that those are subconscious presuppositions in your psychological attitude, how much of an illusion are you living in this contemporary very world, you see? Your tape has run out. Thanks for being concerned. Okay, go ahead, please.
And then the second on the detachment of consciousness from the object. By understanding the unconscious, we free ourselves from its domination. This is really also the purpose of the instructions in our text. This is Jung's comment. And therefore, detachment from the world and concentration on the light of the innermost region is to be obtained. Disillusion of participation mystique, which is the identification with the object as man probably did in primitive stages with all of nature, is to be sought. When there is no consciousness of the difference between subject and object, an unconscious identity prevails. The unconscious is then projected into the object, and the object is introjected into the subject, becoming part of his psychology. Civilized man naturally thinks he is miles above these things. Instead of that, he is often identified with his parents throughout his life, or with his effects and prejudices, and shamelessly accuses others of the things he will not see in himself. But if the unconscious can be recognized as a co-determining factor along with consciousness, and if we can live in such a way that consciousness and unconscious demands are taken into account as far as possible, then the center of gravity of the total personality shifts its position. It is then no longer in the ego, which is merely the center of consciousness, but in the hypothetical point between conscious and unconscious. This new center might be called the self.
Yes, and that was the original statement of Jung. That was the first time that the self was expressed as the goal of individuation. Notice that person making is not to generate an ego. The generation of an ego precedes person making. But once the ego has been generated, then the person has to be further refined, as it were, out of that ore. So that the establishment of your person is a refining of the ego by carrying through a synthesis which completes the analytical movement that created the ego to synthesize the self. And if you don't complete the movement, you don't complete that ecology, it becomes arrested. And it happens all the time. The Taoist saying is that you can always tell a Taoist because their pupils of their eyes are square. Well, how can the pupils of an eye be square? Well, it's a saying. See, it's a symbolic saying. It means that they have fashioned themselves in equanimity. So if you see somebody with square pupils, you know they put a lot of work in. Minimally, you know that. Sorry for adding on.
Thank you. Goes on to say the production and birth of the superior personality is what is meant when our text speaks of the holy fruit, the diamond body, or any other kind of incorruptible body. And psychologically, these expressions symbolize an attitude that is beyond the reach of emotional entanglements and violent shocks, a consciousness detached from the world. He says, I have reasons for believing that this attitude sets in after middle life and is a natural preparation for death. And he goes on, the Chinese yoga philosophy is based upon this instinctive preparation for death as a goal. In analogy with the goal of the first half of life, procreation and reproduction, the means of perpetuating one's physical existence, it takes as the goal of spiritual existence the symbolic begetting and birth of a spirit body, or breath body, which ensures the continuity of detached consciousness. It is the birth of the pneumatic man known to the European from antiquity, but which he seeks to produce by quite other symbols and magical practices, by faith and a Christian way of life.
And this was paragraph 69, and we go up to paragraph 84.
Yes.
How is our time?
12:30.
12:30? Okay, go ahead.
He points out that behind our text, the secret of the golden flower, is a civilization thousands of years old, one which is built up organically on primitive instincts and knows nothing of that brutal morality so suited to us as recently civilized Teutonic barbarians. For this reason, the Chinese are without the impulse towards violent repression of the instincts that poisons our spirituality and makes yet hysterically exaggerated. The man who lives with his instincts can also detach from them, and in just as natural a way as he lives with them. Any idea of heroic self-conquest would be entirely foreign to the spirit of our text, but that is what it would infallibly amount to if we follow the instructions literally. He concludes on this last of this section, a safe foundation is found only when the instinctive premises of the unconscious win the same respect as the views of the conscious mind. His last section of this is on the fulfillment. A growing familiarity with the spirit of the East should be taken merely as a sign that we are beginning to relate to the alien elements within ourselves. Later on the same page, he says that one cannot grasp anything metaphysically, one can only do so psychologically. Therefore, I strip things of their metaphysical wrappings in order to make them objects of psychology. My admiration for the great philosophers of the East is as genuine as my attitude towards their metaphysics is irreverent. I suspect them of being symbolical psychologists to whom no greater wrong could be done than to take them literally. This surprised me. If I assume
it's surprising to read it accurately, isn't it?
If I assume that God is absolute and beyond all human experience, he leaves me cold. I do not affect him, nor does he affect me. But if I know that he is a powerful impulse of my soul, at once I must concern myself with him. Later he says that, therefore, it seems to me far more reasonable to accord the psyche the same validity as the empirical world, and to admit that the former has just as much reality as the latter, as I see it, the psyche is a world in which the ego is contained. Later he points out that the illusion of the supremacy of consciousness makes us say, I live. Once this illusion is shattered by a recognition of the unconscious, the unconscious will appear as something objective in which the ego is included. says that the symbol Christ, the Son of Man, is an analogous psychic experience of a higher spiritual being who is invisibly born in the individual, a pneumatic body which is to serve us as a future dwelling, a body which, as Paul says, is put on like a garment. Later, it is as if the guidance of life had passed over to an invisible center that religious language is full of imagery depicting this feeling of free dependence, of calm acceptance. This remarkable experience seems to me a consequence of the detachment of consciousness, thanks to which the subjective I live becomes the objective it lives me. But the consciousness of being a child of God delivers one from the bondage of the blood. It is also a feeling of reconciliation with all that happens. For which reason, according to the Hui Ming Ching, the gaze of one who has attained fulfillment turns back to the beauty of nature. And then you read some of
I read sections. All the rest of it, yeah.
So that my comments are that in Jung, in trying to understand what he calls practical insights, is trying to understand what he calls practical insights of the Oriental mind, and to do so, he compares Eastern and Western approaches, using the secret of the golden flower as a representative of Eastern wisdom, as though it were all Eastern wisdom, and his European background and own experience in his practice as taking him summarizing Western experience and wisdom. He works on analogies and points out when the two fit as though each are a system. Two of which can be then compared and fitted or not, but tends to label the Eastern as intuitive and instinctual and the West as scientific, and part of that science is to understand the mind of the East. But he did try to emphasize the agreement between the psychic states and symbolisms of the East and West.
Thank you for all of your attention and detail. We'll come back next week and go to some others. One thing that you might in a general way consider, do you think that Chinese civilization will stand for the West considering it a weak woman in the world? You ain't seen nothing yet if you think that that is the case. One has to be very critical to understand the world as it really is, and one has to be extremely capable of integration on a very high level to understand what's going to be happening very, very soon now. The delusions of the past are all going to break at the same time. And you can see we're reading a very intelligent human being just 60 years ago. We've come an enormous long way fast. But the way is approaching a threshold. And like all delusions, when the threshold is crossed, it's gone. And that's a new world then. That's a new age when a threshold is passed. So we're gaining some power now. Now it's like here, I'll just for a moment. You read this years ago, not so many years ago.
Four or five
years ago. And the book at that time was something that it was a kind of a struggle to even get to in your experience and your background.
I didn't understand. I thought,
yeah. But now, because of going through this educational process for a while, you're able to come to something like that and deal with it maturely as a person. Accept what you want and criticize what you want and be rather free in terms of the quote authority of the book. That's worth everything. It's worth everything to have that, and that's a liberty. That's the kind of liberty that the founding fathers of this country meant when they talk about liberty. is the liberty to take yourself to whatever experience and elements occur in your life and to deal with them as you choose. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do. Next week we'll go to visions of Zosimus and Paracelsus. I think we'll get that far, and then hopefully Mercurius. I'm also going to talk about divination next week. We have to, in the magic section, talk about divination. It's very important, so I'll try and make it a little bit clearer to you so that you can understand. Not psychologically clear, but in the traditional magic sense. What happens with divination. You should be able to, after the 2 years of this program, to deal with whatever comes up, whatever it is. And we need to attend to that just for about an hour next week. Please.
Can you just make a comment on Robert's little excerpt? When we had our meeting and he was explaining to us, Justine and myself, what he was going to say, it didn't come out the same way as when he made his cassette, and I was wondering what you got out of it.
What did he? What was different in his comment to you two?
Well, he said he felt that the secret of the golden flower was referring to tantra sex, and that you just washed it away and made it seem a spiritual thing, and I mean, I didn't get that out of what he was saying at all. I don't know what he was saying on the cassette now.
Well, why don't we, we'll all review the tape, and we'll see what he said on it, and talk about that next week. So we'll talk about divination and sex. That should fill the house. Is Mr. Owens.
I've been looking for the tantric section of town for the longest time.
The tantric district.